Hello friends, the next topic, Dr. Johnson as a critic. Introduction. Johnson's critical writing or living literature as Dryden, for instance, are not Johnson's criticism. Most of it belong with the living classics. It can be read afresh every year with unaffected pleasure and new stimulus. It is alive and life-giving. Dr. Lewis in Securitini, Volume 12. Dr. Johnson was the grand champ of the realm of the latter of his day, a critic observed. There are four great dictatorial figures in English literature, each of whom seems to have been recognized in his eyes as supreme authority in the realm of letters. In the time of James I, there was Ben Jonson ringing in the Meredith Tavern. After the Restoration came Dryden to give his view in the coffee houses. Then followed Pope, and after him arose Dr. Johnson to utter his downright judgment in tavern, the drawing room and bookshops, and at the literary club. As the clear from Boswell's inimitable biography, The Life of Dr. Johnson, Dr. Johnson was particularly good at proseful and witty conversation. Indeed, the last 30 years of his life he spent talking and by overwhelming his friend and foes alike. He gathered around himself a galaxy of most important literary figures of the age. The club was organized in 1764, and from then till his death in 1784, Dr. Johnson completely dominated it. Moody and Lovett maintain that Dr. Johnson's so-called dictatorship of English literature was largely the result of his conversational supremacy in the literary club, which included nearly all the famous writers of the time. Among these famous writers were Sir Joshua Reynolds, the famous painter, Garrick, the actor, Malone, the Shakespearean scholar, Bishop Percy, the collector of ballads, Adam Smith, the political economist, Gibbon, the historian, Boswell, Fox, Brooke, the orator, and Oliver Goldsmith. They met, Boswell tells us, at the Turk's Head in Gerrard Street. So, on evening in every week at 7, and generally continued their conversation till a pretty late hour. Dr. Johnson was the soul of his learned assembly, and acted visible as the dictator thereof. His equipment as a critic. As critic of literature, Dr. Johnson was well equipped. About his classical reading, there cannot be any doubt. He had an amazingly retentive memory and could cite passage after passage from English and classical poetry without having to look at the next. He had tremendous mental vigor as well as clarity of perception. His acuteness of observation has combined with the wonderful conjure of judgment and expression. Of all the English critics, Johnson is the last of men's matter. He is very forthright, even downright. He has some central point of view which he defends with all his bullish strength. Last but not least is his delightful style. But he has many limitations too. He is a man of very strong likes and dislikes. The dislikes begin much stronger than the likes. He has pet prejudices which impair some of the criticism. Many have questioned his ear, and some have attacked his dogmatism and his incapacity of appreciate what is dubiously called pure poetry. Preface to Shakespeare. The two important works of Dr. Johnson as critic are the Preface to Shakespeare and second, Leaves of the Poets. Let us consider the first of two and see what idea of Johnson as a critic it gives. Johnson's Preface to Shakespeare, appended to his edition of Shakespeare, is, in the words of David Dessay, in inverted comma, one of the noblest monument of English neoclassical criticism, and an exposure of some of weakness, contradictions and unnecessary rigidities of some widely accepted neoclassical principle, its pungent style, emphatic clarity, and tendency to epigrammatic summing up of each argument carried its ideas home with enormous force. In order to come close, no modern editor of Shakespeare can ignore what Johnson had to say about Shakespeare, his comments on characters, his quick illuminating note on the meaning of words, and his general assessment of Shakespeare as a poet of poet and dramatist. The preface represents effectively all the good and the bad qualities of Johnson as a critic. It is, according to a critic in inverted comma, certainly the most masterly piece of literary criticism. All Johnson's gifts are seen at their best in it. The lucidity, the virile energy, the individuality of his style, the unique power of first placing himself on the level of plain man and then lifting the plain man to his, the resolute insistence of life and reason, not learning and ingenuity as the standard by which books are to be judged. Not comma closed. Johnson neglect the merit of the other Elizabethans and pay his glowing tribute to Shakespeare. The stream of time which is continually washing dissoluble fabrics of other poets, possessed without injury by the adamant of Shakespeare, poetic reputation blaze up and windle and fire which heartened it on one generation will be but cold ashes to the next. At for 3 centuries Shakespeare fame as glowed so steadily that he has come to be looked on as the supreme expression of not only the English race but of whole world. Note comma closed. The basis of Johnson's exaltation of Shakespeare is essentially neoclassic. He does not passively accept the decision of generation after generation. According to him, in inverted comma, nothing can please many and please long, but just representation of general nature. Note comma closed. This is the neoclassical expression of Aristotle's conception of imitation. Shakespeare is great because he is a poet, not to freak and whim, but the general human nature, which is still the same. Shakespeare person act and speak by the influence of those general passion and principle by which all mind and agitated and the whole system of life is continued in motion. The emphasis of general truth rather than on the investigation of detail in basic tenet of neoclassic school, to generalize is to be an idiot, said Black, but the neoclassics did not count the stick of a tulip. Johnson is, however, not a straight-jacketed neoclassicist. He admits of an occasional departure even from his pet principle. As he put it, there is always an appeal, often from criticism to nature. The imitation of general nature, which he insists on, should, in his opinion, he subjected to moral and didactic consideration. The end of writing, Johnson says, is to instruct. The end of poetry is to instruct by pleasing. This is Shakespeare's fault. He sacrificed virtue to convenience and is so much more careful to please than to instruct, that he seems to write without any moral purpose. Thus, one of the reasons we praise Shakespeare for is treated by Johnson as his defect. This also explains Johnson's play for poetic justice. He supports the happy ending of King Lear as maneuvered by Nahum, Tate, and others. He admits that a play in which the virtuous suffer and the weak prosper is a just representation of the common event of human life. But even then, the playwright should preferably slow the final trump of seductive virtue, as that will please to audience more. Johnson does not so evidence of any real grasp of Shakespeare's poetic power. He feels that Shakespeare was better at comedy than tragedy, nor is he aware the psychological subtleties of his characterization. His criticism of Shakespeare's verbal equivalent is also indicative of his deficiency of perception. Shakespeare's puns, truly speaking, are not always senseless. When Margaret or Richardson III says, "Antern, the son of said, alas, alas, witness my son now in the set of death." She is not just playing on the word son, son, and said. She is in fact fulfilling a deeply compulsive psychological necessity. Her word play is, in the word of Oliver Elton, in the nature of safety valve with a green kind of hiss in it for the escape of passion. The Lives of Poets. Johnson's most mature and sustained critical work is The Lives of the Poet, originally published as Prefaces, Biographical, and the Critical of the Works of English Poets between 1779 and 1781. It was intended to be a series of introduction to the works of the English poet from Cowley and Milton down to Johnson contemporaries like Akenside and Gray. As many as 52 poets are dealt with, it is characteristic of the work that it deals with only the poets of the neoclassical tradition. The David Dessay says, "For the most part, Johnson is dealing with men writing in a tradition he understood and employing the kind of verse for which he had an extremely accurate ear." Many of the poets dealt with or read by nobody nowadays, Thomas Alden, Adam Smith, William King, James Hammond, and Gilbert West. Only six of the rest, Milton, Dryden, Pope, Thomson, Collins, and Gray, are the real significance today. In each of Lewis, Johnson gives the biographical fact about the poet, his observation on his character, and then a critical assessment of his poetry. Except in the case of the minor poet, he makes little contribution to biographical fact. Anyway, his style is attractive. Throughout, we may not accept the Lives of the Poets as a guide, but certainly it is a good companion. Johnson's criticism is of the judicial kind. He passes a clear verdict on every poet. He defined in his dictionary a critic as a man skilled in the art of judging literature, a man able to distinguish the fault of beauties of writing. Obviously, the emphasis is on judgment and discrimination. His methods and conception of the function of a critic were later to be opposed by the poet and critic of the Romantic school, who puts emphasis not on judicial verdict of the verdict, but on the imaginative interpretation of literature. Not come closed. Dr. Johnson's premises as a critic in this work are as essentially neoclassics as in his criticism of Shakespeare. Again, his insistence on the function of poetry, to instruct by pleasing, is ubiquitous. All poetry is the work of genius, and genius is that power which constitutes a poet. That quality without which judgment is cold and knowledge is inert, that energy which collects, combines, amplifies, and animates. Invention, imagination, and judgment are included in genius. What is a poet, according to Johnson? The answer, as interpreted by David Dessay, is as follows in inverted comma. The poet is a man seeking to give pleasure by conveying general truth about experience with freshness and skill. The question to be asked of a given poet are, what kind of a man, living in the what is of circumstance, was he, and being that sort of a man, With what degree of success did he produce work capable of giving pleasure by their truth of liveliness? Note comma closed. The emphasis is given on just representation of general nature. Any departure from this basic neoclassic prerequisite is shortly opposed by Dr. Johnson. Of course, some strong personal prejudice also have a free play in his criticism. Thus, Milton is partly attacked on political ground. In order to come, Milton republicanism was I am afraid, founded in an evanescent hatred of greatness and a sullen desire of independence in petulance, impatience of control, and pride disdainful of superiority. In order to come, closed. Johnson's contempt for Milton's sonnet is due to his dislike of the sonnet as a poetic form. He is harsh to Swift as he somewhat suspects his religious sincerity. Such instance, the prejudiced views can easily be multiplied. We certainly agree with George Sherburn that Johnson's error or gross open the bubble. However, most of Johnson's adverse opinion spring not from his literary and non-literary prejudice, but his central point of view regarding the purpose and function of literature. This point of view is built mainly on the neoclassic premises, though with some very vital difference. Take for instance his condemnation of Cowley and the entire line of metaphysical poets. His views are in strict accordance with the spirit of his age. The chief fault of the metaphysicals in the eyes of Johnson is their sacrifice of the general for the particular and their excessive love of heavy learning. He observes, in inverted comma, the fault of Cowley and perhaps all the writers of the metaphysical race is that of pursuing his thoughts to their lost ramification, by which he loses the grandeur of generality. This is what he has to say about metaphysical wit. The most heterogeneous idea were yoked by violence together. Nature and art are rancid, or illustration, comparison, and allusion, their learning instruct, their subtly surprise. Dr. Johnson has been frequently pilloried for his condemnation of Milton's Lycidas. His condemnation was not, however, the unthinking stricture of a fanatic, but a natural product of his fundamental attitude. The poet, as we have already pointed out, must, according to Johnson, give representation of general nature with two use Dutch's word again, truth and loveliness, that is novelty. He should maintain a delicate balance between the two. If he adheres to truth too strictly at the cost of loveliness, the odds are that his representation will become mechanical, as he will usually employ highly traditional diction, idiom, and imagery, on the contrary of the strive too much for novelty. It is likely that we will depart considerably from truth and get bogged down in his own whimsies. The first is the fault of Milton's in Lycidas, and the second that the metaphysicals. Both are faults, but the latter is somewhat less serious than the former. David Dess observed that in the last analysis, Johnson held that exhibitionist novelty was better than the mechanical reception of hereditary smile. In condemning Lycidas, Johnson still shows his sense and beautiful poetry, which Milton has been able to create, even which is schoolboy similes and images. This deficiency of appreciating the strictly aesthetic merit of poetry leads Johnson to unfair criticism of Gray and Collins, however often called the precursors of Romanticism. His disapproval to Gray is not really due to his disapproval of all romantic tendencies, but due to his disapproval of all artificial and extravagant language. The same for which he takes Lister to task. Basically, Johnson was against the use of classical mythology in modern English poetry. He maintained a vigorous independence from most neoclassical dogmas, his leniency about the three dramatic unities, and his disregard of the rigid conception of kind and the rule of decorum. An instance in point, further, we must remember that he made important concessions. He helped Percy over the reliquies. He appreciated second Penseroso and Gronzer Hill. He praised the castle of Indolence, and he got over his dislike of blank verse while dealing with Milton, Thomson, and Akenside. His objection against blank verse was not that it was not good, but that good blank verse was seldom written. His aesthetic capacity might be questioned, but not his liberalism as a critic. He was not at all deaf to the newer and richer poetry which had begun to be written in his age. However, he is at his best when dealing with the poet who write that kind of poetry with which he is effortlessly in rapport. His criticism of Dryden and Pope is really remarkable. The famous passage in which he compares the two poets in the world of David Duchess in order comma, he had a permanent effect on the history of the reputation of those two poets, not comma closed. The business of criticism, in Johnson's own word, is to free literary judgment from the anarchy of ignorance, the caprice of fancy, and the tyranny of prescription, and to assign value on rational ground. In his practice, Johnson was true to his conception. He may be charged with neoclassic bias, but M.H. Abraham meets this charge well in inverted comma. If Johnson read Milton and Donne, throw the spectacle of Pope, Wordsworth, and Coleridge, read Pope through the spectacle of Milton, while more recent critics have read Wordsworth and Coleridge and Milton through the spectacles of Donne, inverted comma closed. It may be more difficult to absolve Johnson of his prejudice, but the normal sanity of his judgment is abundant gusto, and pointed expression cannot be overlooked. He can at delight, if not guide us. The topic, Dr. Johnson as a critic, over.